The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Love. Courage. Truth.
Catastrophe looms over Miami, and it's not just Hurricane Irma. Before the storm arrives, Miami has already had the third worst real estate market among American cities, major American cities. Only Cleveland and Detroit rank lower than Miami in foreclosure rates and delinquent mortgages. Last year, Miami had over 7,000 home foreclosures. 7,000 home foreclosures. This year, the number is already over 3,600. Now Irma is bearing down on South Florida. Category 5 hurricane could make landfall in Miami this weekend. Human toll, of course, the main concern. But the combination of a devastating hurricane hitting a real estate market that is already in shambles could be catastrophic for the entire country, especially if there is any kind of flooding like we have seen in Houston. Flooding in the Miami area already is a serious problem under normal circumstances, never mind a hurricane. Miami just spent $500 million to install anti-flood pumps all around the city, but only 15% of them have been installed so far. Even if they were, engineers warned the pumps would probably fail during a hurricane because there's no backup generators if the city loses power. I mean, who would want a backup generator, you know, in a city that gets hurricanes? You don't need that. By the way, that's exactly what happened last month. A heavy rainstorm, not a hurricane, just a heavy rainstorm overwhelmed the pump's capacity and caused a power outage that knocked two pump stations offline for almost an hour, long enough to put sections of Miami Beach under several feet of water. Do you remember the Great Miami Storm of July 2017? No, neither does anybody else. It was a rainstorm. This is Irma. We need to concentrate on the things that are really important. And boy, there's a ton happening today. But I want to make you aware that there's only so much a body, a person, and a people and a country can take. War, chaos in the streets, two major hurricanes, another one now developing right behind it. Let's pray for safety. Let's pray that Irma misses. And we miss a housing collapse. Catastrophe could be in the air. But it's not just Hurricane Irma.
Thursday, September 7th. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
This is why we have to know who we are as a people and know what's important and hold on to our values and our principles. The hurricane, the winds are blowing everywhere, but I don't think there were heavier winds than the winds that were blowing in Washington, D.C. yesterday. I mean, there's always hot air. There's always a ton of hot air blowing in Washington, D.C. But yesterday, the winds changed, and it was remarkable. May I just take you back for just a second, and review the past and see if there was anyone that might give us a piece of advice on what happened yesterday? We have the Ted Cruz.
If as a voter you think what we need is more Republicans in Washington to cut a deal with Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, then I guess Donald Trump's your guy.
Typical lying Ted.
Ouch.
I'll say this, Glenn. Harry Reid's retired. That was a lie. He only cut the deal with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah. Could you explain exactly what happened yesterday, Stu? Because
it's pretty amazing. They went into a debt ceiling sort of conference. It was supposed to be a bipartisan negotiation. What it seems like from all the reporting, there's been no disagreement from the White House on this. Donald Trump, the Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan, all in a room. McConnell and Ryan trying to basically say, hey, we want 18 months of this if we're, you know, so they're trying to get a stronger negotiating position. On the other side is are the Democrats, and they say they don't want, they want to get stuff for their debt ceiling votes. This is what's happened every single time. So the Republicans say we want 18 months. Democrats say, no, we're not doing that. They jump in again and say, well, what if we do something shorter, 6 months? The Democrats say, well, I don't know, maybe we'll give you three. And then Trump jumps in and says, you know what? Yeah, three. And the problem is it's a deal that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are celebrating. They love this deal. It's put them in a much stronger negotiating position on every other part of this. And I guess the larger point here is whether you were a reluctant Trump voter or an enthusiastic Trump voter, there's no one who voted for Donald Trump so that he could make deals with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer.
But what if this is the right deal, Stu? I'm not against making deals with the Democrats. I mean, as long as it's the right deal.
Really? I mean, again, you're right. If they come up with lower taxes and better things, I guess that would be...
Well, Chuck Schumer was talking... No, I'm sorry, not Chuck Schumer. Who is the Democrat that he put on the plane with him yesterday? Did you read this article? I don't have it here in front of me. I have it for later in the program. He put a Democrat on Air Force One with him yesterday, and they were talking. And she said, "You know why?
Heitkamp.
Heitkamp. I want to hear what he has to say about taxes. You know, maybe we can come together on taxes."
Well, it's interesting because Heitkamp is you know a Democrat in a state that voted for, what's, you know, 70% for Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Very popular.
Yeah.
Tax reform is very popular in the state.
Yes.
So look, this is the thing. If you can convince Democrats to vote for your stuff, great. When you are abandoning your stuff to vote with Democrats, bad.
Okay, so here's the thing. I've been trying to think of ways to explain how I feel today. No, not how I feel. No, I don't think I'm going to express how I feel today. I'm just going to express what happened yesterday. And I've come up with three ways to explain it. One, a casino. Two, golf. And three, Aztec soccer. Where do you want to start? You start with a casino? Let's start with the casino. Here's what the game we're playing. We have decided that winning is all we want to do. We want to beat the house. We're going to beat the house. We're going to win and we're going to beat the casino. That's not the same as saying, I want to win and leave with more money than the casino kept. All I want to do is beat the house. I want to have them lose. Okay. There's a couple of things that could happen. If you just want to make sure that the casino loses, you will forget about how much they're charging you in food, in the hotel rooms, and everything else, because you're just focused on winning at the table. So they might even let you win at the table. But you didn't really accomplish your goal. You were just so focused on beating them at the table that you failed to see that they just raped you for the rest of the weekend. You actually left with a lot less money. Oh, no, but you won at the table. The table wasn't the game you should be paying attention to. Because that was no longer the game the casino was playing. The casino was saying, let's get the real money. Not the chump change that we're putting down on the floor. There's example number one. Be careful on what your goal is. And make sure that it is specific enough. Oh, by the way, there's another way that this could be played out of the casino. If all you care about is making sure that you win, if the casino knows that and they start to say, you know what, they hate us so much, all they want to do is win. If we start making it so... if we lose, we end up making more money. For instance, let's do this. Let's make sure that we're paying everything out. Let's just make sure that we're paying out, that you're just making a ton of money at the table, and we want you to win and take that money from us. If you're only concerned about them losing and they've changed the game on you, you actually lose. Because all you're concerned about is them losing. But if they're paying out in a different way, what have you done? What have you won? Nothing. You walk out feeling good, but they changed the rules on you. Let me go to golf. Let's try golf. Aren't you tired of going to the golf course and just having a crappy day? You just can never get it right, no matter what you do. And all your friends are better. And you go out and you just keep swinging away, but you're tired of losing. And somebody comes up to you and says, you know what? I'm going to make sure you win. I'm going to make sure that you win. Here's what we're going to do. First of all, this game is stupid. We're going to revolutionize this game. This game is the dumbest thing ever. First of all, they're lying to you. They're all lying to you. Have you ever heard of a game where the low score wins? No. Is it low score wins in football? No. Basketball? No. Soccer? No. Rugby? Cricket? Anything? Low score wins? No. No. They've been lying to you. High score wins. Now you're playing golf, and the guy who's your coach, the guy who's leading your team to victory, is telling you high score wins. And everybody who is telling you it's low score wins, they're lying to you. So the people who are on the side and they're doing the polite little golf claps and they're like, by the way, low score wins. If all you want to do is win and you've forgotten the principles of the game you're playing, you don't get the cup at the end. Because you've forgotten the basic principles of the game you're playing. And you can say you're going to revolutionize golf. We're all going to revolutionize golf. Well, not if you're playing with the guy who actually owns the club. And he somehow or another is the one who's convinced you low score wins. He's winning anyway because you've paid him to be on the golf course. He wins. You lose. Last one. Aztec soccer. I don't know how the Aztecs lasted as long as they did. Everybody tried to win Aztec soccer. Except, if I'm not mistaken, the ones who won in Aztec soccer were the ones to be sacrificed. I don't know. I mean, if my coach is like, and you're going to get sick of winning, we're going to win so much. I'm like, I think I want to be sick of losing because the people who win are going to die. So I won't have the opportunity to win again. So I think I'm going to let this one go. The Aztecs cheered on. And the teams, actually, I don't know about you, but I'd want to be on the team that sucked. I think I would be rooting for a guy like me to be on the soccer team if winning meant we all died. Here's the problem with the Aztec soccer, as I understand it. Nobody was really looking at the cup. Everybody was wanting to win. But did you look at what winning meant? That would be one time I would win once and I'd be like, yeah, I am sick of winning. I am sick of winning. Yeah. I didn't know we were all going to die here. It's important that you look at what your goal is. It's important that you remember the rules of the game And it's important that you actually examine what you're trying to win in the end. It seems to me we have forgotten all three of those lessons. And probably one more. And it's weird because I think I started this week with North Korea. This is not a game. This is real life. The only way to win is to not play the game. When you happen to be online or whatever, your phone rings, and you hear a voice say,
"Shall we play a game?"
The answer should be, no. No. Let's not play a game. Because the only way to win is to not play. I really want to hear from you today because I want to know how you're feeling. I want to know what you're feeling. I want to how do we process this one? It seems as though the president has done what some have feared, and that is sell everybody down the river and just start siding with the Democrats. And we've talked to a few people on Capitol Hill today, at least our producers and writers from The Blaze have, and they have said that it's eerie, that Capitol Hill is eerie today. Nobody really knows what to do and how to talk to each other. They said it's just it's deadly silent in the Capitol because no one knows what to say. So what do we say? Where are we on this? What does this mean? How do you feel? You're a Trump supporter. You're not a Trump supporter. How do you process this? 888-727-BECK. 888-727-BECK is the phone number.
It's a strange place to be because I think, a lot of the stuff he did say he would do during the campaign, he did promise to be the deal maker. He did promise to be the guy who would reach across the aisle and do these things. I think a lot of people believed he was kind of just saying that in the campaign and that when he got into office, he would do the opposite.
I don't mind. I mean, you're going to make a deal. I don't mind making a deal. But what have we lost? We've lost any ground on the deficit matters, the debt matters, spending under control, DACA. We're going to lose. We're already negotiating now for, comprehensive immigration reform, which is the thing that Donald Trump used to run everyone off the stage.
To win the nomination
presidency.
And win the presidency.
He said that he was not going to take any kind of budget deal that didn't include, this was just a few weeks ago, that didn't include money for the border. Well, there's no money for the border in this. So what did you gain? What did Donald Trump gain? What did the Republicans gain? What did conservatives gain? Where is the gain here? Where is the win?
Yeah, because I think the typical way you go into this is step one, win. Step two, get your policy results. With Trump, it's step one, win. Step two, see step one.
Mercury.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Let's go to Jake in Virginia. Hello, Jake. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Mr. Beck. How you doing?
Very good.
So I know you were calling and asking people to kind of call in and tell you what they were thinking and feeling. I'm 23. Mm-hmm. I'm in college now. I got married 3 years ago when I had just turned 20. My wife was 19. And she just graduated from nursing school, and she's a nurse. And as I kind of look out into the future and see a growing debt, politicians who aren't necessarily being honest with us, North Korea tensions rising. It kind of makes me fearful because, A, my generation is showing a lack of motivation for driving towards better things, and politicians aren't really being honest with us. So it makes me fearful of what my future will look like because, A, I don't want to enter into a draft. B, I don't want to even send anyone else to war for me. And I want to graduate and have a decent job. So I'm very fearful about what the future looks like.
So let me ask you this, Jake. Why do you say that your generation is not driving towards greater things? Because in some ways, it depends on who you're surrounded by, I guess. I see millennials that are driving towards better things.
I definitely think there is a small pocket of that. However, I think that if you're going to like a university, there is a lot of like, you know, like it's like who you see with the Bernie supporters. It's like it's all the millennials following who are just striving for this socialism ideal that is ineffective and cannot work out. And they don't do the research themselves to look into what socialism does in Venezuela or North Korea or Cuba or, and you know, I've traveled like all over the world with my dad and I've seen those things play out. And I don't think that my generation has necessarily seen those things play out because they were raised in a relatively peaceful bubble.
Yeah. And you're worried about DACA. Why exactly?
I'm worried about DACA because I feel like they don't see the long-term, or like my generation doesn't look at the long-term economical instability that will cause.
In what way?
I think it will make jobs harder to find, and I think that it will make civil unrest, which would be my main concern. I feel like that would cause some kind of economic fallout, as if right and left are just constantly after each other.
And it would cause economic unrest. Why?
Just because I think that civil unrest naturally causes economic.
Right, but why would it cause? Wait, why would DACA cause civil unrest?
Personally, I think it would just simply be because the right is so like anti the dream, or like wanting to stop the dreamer mm-hmm. movement.
Yes,
left is so for it. And that's going to make left call out for more racism on the right, or say that the right is racist. The right's going to want to stop that, and then you'll just see civil unrest because they're arguing about who's racist, who's not racist, and stuff like that.
And so what Donald Trump did this week by saying, you know what, let's just make DACA the law. Let's just make it the law the right way and not through a political or a presidential edict. Does that help or hurt, and why?
I don't really know how I feel about it in a political, like personal perspective. I do like that it's not necessarily an executive order being passed.
Yes.
Like I like the fact that it's being sent back to a legislative branch, and that's those constitutional powers are being reestablished. Or well, you know.
Okay. So, but you're for the Dream Act being legalized.
Honestly, I don't really know how I feel about it at all.
All right, Jake.
I don't like the instability between left and right. I wish there could be some common resolution together.
I think you are really the typical American in a good way. I think that's exactly where the typical American is. They're not really sure. At this point, they're not really sure. They just know what's coming on the horizon is not good. The political instability is just not good. Thanks, Jake.
And they don't want the fight, right? Yes. They don't want the argument. Yes. And, you know, but it's amazing. I mean, this was the standard. The standard for being tough on the border was whether you opposed or supported the Dream Act.
Yeah.
Now, he's right. Trump is right to say this is unconstitutional. It was done the wrong way.
He's right.
Get rid of it. He's right on that. But the solution is we need to make sure we get this done another way. When did that become the conservative position on the border? I mean, I don't remember that change.
I think everything has been rearranged. Remember, you see in revolutions, what happens in revolutions is time goes by and they rearrange the deck chairs so many different times that once they sit down, once the deck chairs and the dust settles, it could be arranged in a completely different way. And you would go, oh, no, it's always been like this. This is okay. I think this is the way it's always been. because so much time has gone by and you haven't seen the deck chairs the way they're supposed to be, you know, set for so long that once it's just set in any way, you're like, okay, no, this is right. And I think everything is so in flux that you don't know what's right and wrong anymore. You don't even know what your position was at the beginning or why. Nick in Ohio, go ahead. You're on.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to say about yesterday, it's another knee-jerk reaction and overreaction to everything the president does. Had he not reached out to the left, he would have been condemned. It's not like waiting on the right has been working out for him either. They're not doing anything spectacular to help on anything right now. So he reaches across the aisle and gets something done quickly that's going to help.
What did he get done yesterday? What did he get done yesterday, Nick, that helps you?
It helps me? Yeah. Not a lot. What was tied to the debt ceiling was the help for Texas. The Republicans were trying to tie that money to a long-term approach.
Right.
And it was going to delay that forever while they, well, let's try 18 months. It'll go back again. Well, let's try a year, because it was not going to pass through. Get the money through, we kick it till December, which is better than kicking it 18 months, and see what we can do. At least he's working with the left. They can't complain about that now.
They can, but can't you?
I can. I can complain that nobody's working with him. Again, nothing he does is making anyone happy right now. But it seems like he's at least taking a step forward.
All right. So how do you feel about DACA? You voted for Donald Trump?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So how do you feel about what he did with DACA this week?
I think that's actually a very simple topic. It was done illegally. There was always a standing order. Everybody just kind of looked the other way.
Sure.
What President Obama did was not legal.
Right.
Correct.
So all he did was undo something that was illegal and ask Congress to take a look at it and see what we can officially do about it.
But he's saying really he wants to make it permanent.
He wants to make it law.
So he's actually entrenching it more.
Yes.
To put 800,000 illegal immigrants would get legal status or some form of legal status because the president has demanded the GOP Congress do that. Is that, I mean, because I think there are a lot of people who voted for Trump who like what he's done, but I don't think anybody voted for Trump because he was going to get 800,000 illegal immigrants and give them legal status and then work with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. That's not why anybody voted for him, whether you were, you know, enthusiastic for him or you were, you know, maybe not so enthusiastic.
Well, I think the whole Dreamers thing is ridiculous. But we know that.
Did you believe that? Hang on just a second. Did you believe that when Donald Trump was making fun of little Marco by saying he was for the Dreamers and that he was going to work with the Democratic Congress to get comprehensive immigration reform through? Did you say, well, come on, Donald, this is ridiculous. That's not what Marco is doing. Or did you say, yeah, he's right?
What I think is going to what I wanted to happen was shut the doors, and realistically, we're not going to transport 800,000 people back across the border. They're here. They're fine. Mm-hmm. They're contributing great.
So
there's nothing we're going to do about that.
So did we shut the door?
No.
Did we use DACA as a bargaining chip, something that the left really wanted? And so then we say, okay, we'll work on that, because as you just said, Nick, which I doubt is what you said during the election, because you just said, now look, we're realistically not going to get 800,000 people back. Okay. But did we get a bargaining chip and say, okay, but I need border security? Because the other thing you left out on what he was negotiating for was border security. He said he would shut the 2 weeks ago, I will shut the government down before I do any continuing resolution or anything with the debt ceiling without border security. So you lost the bargaining chip with the Democrats, you lost shutting the door you have just, I mean, read the Huffington Post today. They are thrilled at what they have just received from the president. And what did we receive in return?
Not a lot. The optimist tells me it's all part of the bigger deal. The realist says, yeah, I just screwed up. You know, if he's the deal maker, he says okay. He is. And at this point, we have no choice but to believe that. Then hopefully it's part of the bigger deal.
Okay.
I wish he could get some support from his side, though, because nothing's happening on that side either.
Yeah.
That's the biggest issue. Give him something to work with.
Okay. Nick, thank you very much for your call. I would like to suggest that there is something else. We have no other choice. Yes, you do. Yes, you do. Return to principles and encourage everyone else on the left and the right to return to principles. Because I really, truly believe the first caller we just took, he's the average person. Look, I don't want civil unrest. I don't want civil unrest. I don't want to play this game anymore where we're fighting with each other all the time. I don't want that. I don't want Antifa. I don't want the Nazis. I don't want the extremes. That's the average person. So now the average person can win if we just start to come together and say, look, I'm afraid of my side as much as you're afraid of your side. And I'll admit it. Will you admit that you're afraid of the Antifas of the world? And I'm not talking about the politicians. The last one you're going to get on this bandwagon, the politicians. But the American people need to stand together. And that's where the president can make deals. The president can make deals and say, look, the Dream Act is wrong, but people have been here since they were, you know, an infant. What are we going to do? We have to do something. Now, when I said that, and I said, but I will not negotiate until the border is secure, because I said that we have to look at pieces individually, I was a sellout. But now the president does it, and we get nothing in return. And I'm sorry, but you might as well go and put your wishes and your hopes in John Roberts and his deep plan for Obamacare. And also pin that right onto the tail of a unicorn. There is no strategy here. It is just about winning. Stop it. How about we advance principles that we all have in common? Common sense. Take care of things that we can. Move logically and without the game of politics. There's more to life than just winning. Now, this is incredible. From USA Today, dozens of lobbyists, contractors, and others who make their living influencing the government pay President Trump's companies for membership to his private golf clubs. Now, this is from USA Today. What they did is the golf club membership list are secret. So they've been unable to figure out who's paying the president. So what they did is they took and they correlated a few things to see who's actually playing at the golf courses where the president is.
So the USA Today went through 4,500 members they could find by reviewing social media and a public website. This is the amazing part. They checked it against a public website that golfers use to track their handicaps. And so they were able to find that 50 executives whose companies held federal contracts and 21 lobbyists and trade group officials were in there with Trump. So, and they two-thirds of them played on one of the days that the president was
so
there.
So here's the thing. They've spent all this time, all this money to find out these things about this president. But they wouldn't check the public records of people like Van Jones saying, I am a communist and I'm glad to be in the White House.
He was basically tweeting it.
I mean,
I can't wait. I just showed up at the White House. Can't wait to hang the hammer and sickle.
Mercury. Love. Courage. Truth.
The art of the bad deal. Trump has cut a deal with Democratic leaders to increase the debt limit to finance the government until mid-December. However, the deal isn't about Donald Trump. The deal proposed by Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi combined the debt ceiling increase with relief aid for Harvey victims. Now, we could talk about the GOP's refusal to address runaway spending. We could talk about how unserious Washington is on either side about restraining the deficit and the debt. We could talk about how unserious both sides are about securing the border, because that was also left out of this deal. And this morning, Donald Trump just tweeted, if you're in DACA, don't worry, you're okay. No action for 6 months. Well, Politico just reported that Nancy Pelosi called him this morning and asked him to tweet that, and he did. Now, is that even true? And did Nancy Pelosi, if it is, did she call him and ask him to tweet that because she wanted to make sure that everybody was calm? Or was she just setting the president up so we could score political points one side or the other? We could talk about these things, or we could just look in the mirror and ask the really hard question. How much do we as people actually care about all of this stuff? How much do we actually care about immigration and immigrants, the debt and the debt ceiling? How much do we care? The reason Washington has been able to kick the can down the road to this point is because we put up with it over and over and over again. Our government is not like all governments everywhere else. Our government is a reflection of who we are as a people. And right now, as a country, we are a people that would rather talk about the personalities in a meeting than about the debt ceiling or the debt itself. We would rather whine about our politicians. We'd rather whine about our media. We'd rather gossip about who has hurt feelings than worry about who we've vote for over and over and over again that would lead us to a place where they're passing this bill to the next generation. Yeah, this is a really bad deal. Really bad. But America has turned accepting bad deals into an art form. It's time we ask ourselves some hard questions, and it's time we spit ourselves out of this system.
Thursday, September 7th. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Saw a movie yesterday, night before last. It's Vince Flynn's first Mitch Rapp movie, American Assassin. And I just think Mitch Rapp is one of the best characters in fiction now. In case you don't know, Vince is a... it was the Tom Clancy, I think, of our day. He was just, he was a fantastic writer and a very good friend. And I remember sitting in just outside of my apartment in New York City. He and his wife and his daughter came to have dinner with me. And we sat there and the whole dinner, he talked about how worried he was about me with George Soros. And this is at the beginning of George Soros putting up $1 million to destroy me and my career and everything else. And he just kept focused on that. And then he said, I want to go up to your apartment, Glenn, because we were going to go and have dessert. And he said, I want to come up to your apartment. I'd really like to see, because you really have to secure yourself. And I said, oh, okay. So we go up and we're looking out this windows and he's like, possible surveillance point. And I'm like, Vince, for the love of it, I'm not living in one of your books. And he's like, I'm just telling you, you're messing with George Soros. We sit down and we're having some dessert. And he says to me, I just found out I have cancer. Vince, isn't this probably a more important thing to talk about than what we've been talking about for the last 100 minutes? I didn't know what to say to him other than, if anybody's going to beat it, you are. Because he was convinced he was going to beat it every time I spoke to him. And then he died. He left behind a wife and daughter, just fantastic people. But he also left behind a lot of friends and amazing work. Now, when he died, a lot of us who were fans thought, oh, this character cannot stop. They just made the first Vince Flynn movie, American Assassin, and it opens this weekend. I saw it, and it's absolutely fantastic. But there's the series has continued with a guy named Kyle Mills, who was selected. Imagine, you know, you're the replacement in the Beatles for Paul McCartney or John Lennon. And Kyle Mills stepped to the plate, and there's a new Vince Flynn novel out, Enemy of the State. Welcome to the program. Kyle, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
Some big shoes, and we've talked about this before, some big shoes that you have to fill, and you've done a fantastic job on it. Tell me about the new book, Enemy of the State.
Well, this one is about the Saudi Arabia and kind of puts forth whether or not maybe they had more to do with 9/11 than the government's let on, and that those redacted pages have a lot of information in them that's been kept from the American people. And they're not living up to their agreements to back off of the financing and supporting of terrorism.
Well, that sounds like total fiction. We know, yeah. We know that none of that is true. What are you basing this on, Kyle, other than those redacted pages? I love fiction writers because they have to be accurate. You just have to have more information than you ever let on. What have you seen that led you down this path?
Well, those pages have always kind of fascinated me, and all the other things swirling around about it that has never been clear. No one's ever said, well, this is exactly what happened through the investigations, and we've completely cleared these people. And I think there's a lot of incentive for the United States because of its strategic interests, and this has always been the case with Saudi Arabia, that it seems like we'll sort of, you know, turn a blind eye to just about anything they do. And so that was kind of what I wanted to play with, and also because if you've read Vince's books, and obviously you've talked to him quite a bit, he and I sort of share a distaste for the Saudis, so I thought it'd be fun to explore that a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Your dad, if I'm not mistaken, wasn't your dad one of the investigators on the Lockerbie bombing?
On Pan Am 103, yeah. That happened actually when I was graduating from college, and we found out about it at my college graduation dinner. And then he disappeared to Lockerbie, and I didn't see him for a few months after that.
How much did that affect your life, having your dad, being surrounded by military guys and having your dad do that? How much of your life do you think is a continuation of your dad's? Did we lose him? We lost him.
Do you want to ask me that question, or you want to ask me something?
No.
I can answer some interesting stuff, too. I'm a pretty interesting guy.
No.
Yeah,
Have you ever thought of that, though? How much of your life is a rerun of your dad's?
I know you have. This is something you've dealt with for a long time.
Yeah.
I don't think I have.
Nobody else. Is it just me that does that? I know I overanalyze everything, but I've been thinking about it a lot lately. On how much am I like my dad? How much is a rerun of my dad's life and a continuation of his goals?
It's an interesting question. I don't know how, in the middle of a really cool action thriller movie release interview, you got there. Exactly.
Well, because I think it's interesting that he's writing this stuff now, and his dad was, you know, his dad was on the investigation of the Lockerbie bombing. So, Kyle, I didn't mean to offend you if I offended you with that question, but have you thought about that, on how much of your dad's, how much of your life is a continuation of, in some ways, your dad's work?
A lot of it. I think that incident really affected me, hearing about the reality of what was going on the ground there. You know, it's funny because Mitch Rapp, the character, starts down his path with the, in the CIA because his girlfriend died on that flight.
Right.
And, I mean, hearing the stories of that, I mean, it was such a horrific event. You know, people would call my father and say, there are two kids sitting in their seats in my backyard, and they're sitting there holding hands, and I really need you to come and get them now. And he had no manpower at that point. They were just flying people in, and he'd have to say, you know, you're going to have to wait. Just close your drapes, and we're going to be there as soon as we can. And, I mean, in a way, it had kind of a similar effect on me as it did the character, understanding what that threat is and how great it is.
Except Mitch went on to kill a whole bunch of people, and you started writing books.
You know, and that's a lot easier.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, you do that on Saturday morning in your underpants in your kitchen, where Mitch isn't doing that. When we talk about 9/11, which this book is based on, in Saudi Arabia and everything that's going on, it's the new Vince Flynn book, Enemy of the State. Kyle Mills is the author, and he's with us now. When we look at that, do you think we're ever going to find out, in our lifetime, will we find out what the real involvement was with Saudi Arabia?
I don't think so. I think there's such a strong strategic interest and financial interest between us and Saudi Arabia that everything like that gets buried. But I mean, it's clear, it's obvious that they are huge financiers of terrorism and really of creating the schools that put forward that philosophy.
The American Assassin talks about a nuclear weapon being used, and it was, I just saw it this, 2 days ago, a great movie, great story. But you see nuclear weapons in play and in action. That's something that really we haven't really dealt with since I was a kid. Do you think this is something with, as you're playing this out with Kim Jong-un, is this something that we're going to have to start really dealing with? Do you think we'll see this play out?
It's, you know, it's such a terrifying situation because it's almost less about Korea than it is about China. They created this problem. They refuse to do anything about the problem, and then they prevent other people from doing something about that problem. And so it just gets worse. And it's on that trajectory, and yes, I think at some point it will happen.
So, Kyle, what happens? What should we be doing right now in North Korea?
I think you have to convince China to rein them in. I don't see how there's any path to us acting unilaterally or with a Western coalition.
Do you,
against Korea?
Do you believe we go to war with North Korea? Do you believe that's in the cards?
No. I just don't think it's possible. I think China would come down on us, and we've been there before.
I am thrilled to hear that. The name of the book is Enemy of the State by Kyle Mills. The new Vince Flynn book is out, and the new Vince Flynn movie, American Assassin, comes out. Have you seen it yet, Kyle?
I have.
What'd you think?
I thought it was terrific. I absolutely loved it. I thought Dylan and Michael Keaton did an amazing job.
Yeah.
You know, I those characters are in my head 8 hours a day, and it's exactly what I pictured.
I agree with you, and I think it's a new kind of character. I mean, it makes Jason Bourne seem like, and it was, written in the Cold War. This is a whole new kind of approach to a character, and I love it. Thanks so much, Kyle.
Thanks.
It's Kyle Mills. Vince Flynn's new book, Enemy of the State, a Mitch Rapp novel, and the new Mitch Rapp movie opens this weekend everywhere. Thanks so much for listening. My name is Glenn Beck. Stuber Gear is our executive producer on the program, and here with some cleanup on some stuff. First of all, the movie opens next weekend, not this weekend, if you're a fan of Mitch Rapp. And,
yeah, the book's out now. Movie next week.
Yeah. And then and we should also discuss the poll numbers for the president. He's doing better, is he not?
Yeah, his approval rating has ticked up a little bit, but his handling of Harvey, pretty positive response to it.
I think he's done a good job.
Seems like it, yeah, right? I mean, sometimes you don't know with these things until later, but yeah. I mean, initial reaction is pretty positive. 51% approve of the government's handling of Harvey, while 16% disapprove.
What would you disapprove on?
Well, there's always somebody.
But I mean, what is their main complaint?
We
planted the seeds for this hurricane to hit, and it shouldn't have hit Texas. It should have hit some other state.
Oh, perhaps. You mean our weather machine?
Yeah,
our weather machine is broken. Our hurricane creation machine is a bit of a problem right now.
If you remember,
we created it initially to kill black people in New Orleans.
That's right.
And that's right.
I forgot that was actually something people said. I'm sorry, I forgot.
Yeah, you were mocking. That was a real thing.
I was making something up, and then thanks for reminding me that this is the nightmare we actually all live in now.
42% approve of Trump's efforts, 24% disapprove. So Trump's a little bit more negative than the government overall, but I mean, he's really obviously leading that effort along with FEMA.
This is going to be interesting to watch because Florida is not Texas, obviously, and this could be really bad in Florida. Hopefully not, but we've known this was coming, and they're already out of gas in many of the gas stations as people are exiting and trying to get away from Miami. That's something that, you know, hopefully we're working on to get people gas. There's nothing worse than, you know, hey, I'm evacuating and I can't go anywhere.
Yeah, that's
now I'm stuck on the highway.
The last hurricane that hit Houston,
that's what happened.
They had everyone evacuate and they got out in the middle of the road, ran out of gas, and people died. More people died from the evacuation than they did the actual hurricane.
So that would be something that maybe the president should work on, and those in Washington should be working on getting gas so people can actually evacuate and get out.
The good thing is there's not a lot going on in the world. Like, there's not a lot of threats currently.
No, there's North Korea and nuclear missiles.
Right.
There's now a third hurricane that has developed, Hurricane Jose. And then, of course, you know, the whole economic collapse things.
But it's a good one. It's a good day when you can take one off the board.
Okay.
When you have
a big
problem and we can just take it off the board.
All right,
yeah.
Good.
Well, we think so.
All right. What is it?
Scientists think they've come up with a plan that will save the planet from the super volcano under Yellowstone Park. Who knew?
You didn't know about the super volcano?
We were all going to die.
Oh,
but now, I knew about the super volcano. Obviously, it's been on top of our list.
Yeah.
But now they think they've come up with a solution to solve that.
How are they going to solve that?
What they're going to try to do is cool the magma.
Oh, my gosh.
Just cool it.
Right. How? We're shipping ice to it?
Well, they're going
to
siphon heat until it becomes too cool to erupt.
Ah.
And then they're going to turn that heat into green energy. So I think we're all set.
Oh, my gosh. We've taken more than one problem off the
chart. Mercury. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
So, can I ask you a question? If you're living in a path of a hurricane, as I'm looking at the video of people trying to leave, Hollywood, Florida, and Miami, and they're just stuck in these lines that aren't going anywhere, and then they're running out of gas, and there's no gas along those evacuation routes. Do you not just look at this and go, you know what? I'm just staying. I mean, I was talking to a guy because I can't take the tornadoes here. It just drives me nuts. I don't know why every house in Texas does not have a tornado shelter. But maybe it's, you know, real Texans are like, tornadoes or nothing. But they freak people out from the north. And so I was talking to a guy who does shelters. And he said, whatever you do, do not put the shelter outside. Make sure the shelter is inside the house. And I'm like, well, I don't even where. I mean, what are you talking about? Well, put it in the garage. Well, then where do I put my car? Well, I don't know. But you don't want your hurricane shelter outside. Why? Because here's what happens. And I can see this. You're going through a hurricane or you're going through a tornado. And the tornado warnings go off. We do right now. All the kids come down and they climb into bed. I get up, make sure that we can crawl, you know, get underneath the house if we have to. But everybody just crawls into bed and then we just watch the TV or the phone. And we're watching where they're landing. Hoping that we're not going to be sucked up into it. What he said was people build their shelters outside of the house. And then when it happens in the middle of the night, you're like, I'm not going to go sit out there. It's hot. I'm going to get all wet. I'm going to have to change into my clothes to get out there. And then you do it a couple of times and then nothing happens. And then you're like, I'm not going to get up. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. Nothing's going to happen. So you don't even get into the shelter at all. You know what I mean?
Oh, totally.
And so then you're sucked up in the house with the shelter outside because you didn't want to go outside and get wet. And especially if you have a family. Well, this is the kind of stuff that makes, if I were in Florida today, I would see all these lines and no one getting gas. And I'd be like, honey, we're not going to make it. You would rather sit in line and run out of gas. And then when the flooding comes in, we're there. With the sea of humanity on the highway with a car that won't go anywhere?
Yeah, it's a legitimate problem. I think a lot of these places have shelters where they're actually having protected areas where people can go that are local and can't get out. Because at some point, this is what happened with Houston. They said, look, we can recommend an evacuation, but it could cause more problems than it solves. And so people wound up having to make do with what was around them. And that's why when these things come in and they're getting to that point where they can really tell where these things are going within 4 or 5 days pretty well. And if you see something like this barreling down in your state, you don't leave 2 days before, you leave 5 days before.
Yeah.
It's really the only chance you have.
But are you? I mean, how many people can say, I'm leaving my job 5 days in advance?
I know, it's hard. But I mean
there is another idea. I hate to say it. Don't live by the coast.
Yeah.
I mean, here's the real problem. Is the hurricanes are not getting stronger or anything else. We're just living by the coast more.
It's true. I mean, when they talk about the damages from hurricanes, there's a lot of big damaging hurricanes in recent memory. The reason for that, you know, people with the global warming side of it will say, well, it's getting warmer and they're getting more damaging. Well, what's happened is we decided to build giant skyscrapers 3 feet from the beach. You're getting really expensive, brand new buildings very close to the coast with a large population centers getting larger and larger. People obviously are not listening to Al Gore, including, by the way, people like Al Gore who build homes near the coast. But, you know, it's that pitch has not been successful. And I don't think it should be successful for that reason. But people used to realize, I mean, this is what happened with the old days with the hurricane, where 1920s, where it wiped out Miami and people just stopped moving. Man, they just wanted to move away. They didn't publicize that hurricane in the 20s because Miami was afraid no one would come.
Well, let me give you, there's two of them. There's 1926 Miami hurricane. 200,000 people were living right in the path. Most of them from the north. They were lured there by the, you know, easy money and the land boom. Hey, you got to buy something in Florida. Everybody's going to move. All of New York one day is going to, I got to move to Florida. Quick, buy some land. So people went down, they bought land. Most of them never even heard of a hurricane before. They had never been in one. So the first one in 26, there were no radios, really. There's only one radio station in all of Florida. So people didn't know what was going on. They saw this. They battened down for this big storm. A lot of them survive until the eye hits. And because they didn't understand what a hurricane was, the eye comes in they all get out and they're like, oh my gosh, it's all over. This is great. Most of the people died on the second half, the return of the eye, the return of the hurricane on the after the eye, because they were all out. They had, you know, they had stopped hunkering down, and now all the debris and everything was swept up, and that's where most people died. Now, that was in 26. It was $164 billion in today's dollars.
Which is would be bigger than Katrina.
Okay, think of that. Now, that's 26. In 1928, they had another one. Before landing in Florida, it killed 1,500 people in the Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, and the Bahamas. 1,500. It's the second deadliest hurricane in the U.S. behind the Galveston hurricane of 1900. It's Category 5. It hit right close to West Palm Beach. 1,700 homes just blown off the face of the earth. And a storm surge caused Lake Okeechobee to overflow, and it put the surrounding areas 15 feet underwater. 2,500 people drown. They think it was closer to 3,000, but we still don't know how many people died in that, because it was 1928, and this was, everybody knew if Florida goes down, the entire country is going to go down. Florida went into a depression a year before the Great Depression because of this hurricane. When this hurricane hit, it's called the Forgotten Storm, because the politicians tried to lower the numbers of the dead, tried to not publicize this storm, because they knew, as Stu said, tourism would come if people weren't afraid. But if people were afraid, nobody was going to come to Florida. So they were actually, they had so many bodies that the government came in and they just started bonfires and they just started burning bodies in the streets and tried to keep that out of the press. So, you know, summer came and, hey, come down to Florida and go to the beach. No, it was just a big campfire. We were making s'mores. Don't worry. That was just a big campfire. That's how much control the government had back then and how bad the communication was. Can you imagine that? And being able to say, look, we got to keep this quiet. Otherwise, this is really going to hurt tourism.
By the way, everyone is going to the same website. Everyone goes there every day, of course, the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory, site of the NOAA. And that's, I mean, I think a lot of people are checking it out today.
Yeah, I live there.
Not a lot of people apparently on the global warming side of the argument, however. They seem to have forgotten this report. This, I will say, it does come back. We're talking August 30th. 2017. Do you remember that era?
It's hard to
put myself in that mindset of August 30th, 2017.
No, that was a disco era, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was. I think it was.
Yeah.
They released a report about global warming and hurricanes.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you a couple clips from it. It is premature to conclude that human activities, and particularly greenhouse gas emissions that cause global warming, have already had a detectable impact on Atlantic hurricane or global tropical cyclone activity. So they haven't even been able to detect that yet. Now, people will say, well, maybe they will in the future, and maybe they will. Maybe they will. That is not the standard set by Al Gore. He put a hurricane on his poster for An Inconvenient Truth to tell us the scientific consensus. And the scientific consensus was, of course, as we all know, that we were screwed when it came to hurricanes. But listen to this. In summary, neither our model projections for the 21st century nor our analysis of trends in Atlantic hurricane and tropical storms counts over the past 120 years support the notion that greenhouse gas-induced warming leads to large increases in either tropical storm or overall hurricane numbers in the Atlantic.
But that's just NOAA saying that, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just...
And we all know there was no ark, right?
No, not that Noah.
No, you said it was Noah. Yeah, I know, but we're just going to leave it at Noah, because we know he didn't exist.
Yeah.
As long as we can throw the Bible in there, then you could just dismiss it and you don't even have to think about it. Sure, it was that Noah. Not the other one that has, you know, real credibility with the left. It's not that the world is upside down. It's just the maps have been wrong. And Dennis Rodman is our hero. This makes sense. Dennis Rodman is the guy who's going to come in and save us. I don't know if you saw, he did an interview in England about Kim Jong-un, and he is the guy to send in. Now, that may sound crazy, but once you listen to him, you realize, no, we need to listen to him a little bit more.
You've spent a lot of time with Kim Jong-un. Is he mad? Is he stupid? How would you describe him as a human being?
You know, it's amazing how we became such good friends with Russia all of a sudden, with Donald Trump. And for years and years, over the course of time, we became such have a great relationship with Russia all of a sudden in America. But for some reason with North Korea, we have a big issue. Mm. And for me to go over there to see him as much as I have, I basically hang out with him all the time. We laugh. We sing karaoke. We do a lot of cool things together.
Stop.
This is awesome so far.
I don't know if you could categorize doing karaoke as cool, ever. I mean, I just don't think so. Yeah, we do a lot of things. You know, two guys, two grown men. You know, we just hang out, do karaoke. I don't know.
Wow, you really have stopped drinking, haven't you?
All
right. It's now confirmed.
I have. No, I don't think that's cool. And, you know, hey, we just hang out. You know, we play karaoke. And, you know, we don't talk politics, you know, or the hundreds of thousands of people that he's got starving in concentration camps. You know, we just hang out and talk about the important things, you know, like
it's not really an uplifting conversation.
No,
the whole concentration camp.
No, but maybe it is something that you might want to bring up.
We ride horses. We hang out. We go skiing. And we hardly ever talk politics. That's the good thing about that.
Yeah.
To me, I think if the president even tries to reach out for Kim, I think it would be a great possibility. Things can happen. If Donald Trump, they can sit down and have some type of mutual conversation. It ought to be like a friendship conversation, just a mutual conversation saying, hi, I would love to, you know, engage in some words in politics and over the history of your country and my country, and just try to start some dialogue. I think that'll open the door just a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Because we have, you know, there's... I want to hear the history of, you know, our country and your country and the lack of concentration camps in our country and the reliance on the concentration camps in your country.
The plethora of concentration camps.
I just think that I don't know why. Maybe it's just me, but the whole concentration camp thing seems important.
It does. Although I don't think that's the problem here, honestly. The problem here is fundamentally... they want to remain a nuclear power, and we are saying we don't want them to be nuclear power. And if you can't bridge that gap, and this is what, by the way, Russia and China are arguing, just recognize they're a nuclear power. It's over. They're a nuclear power. Go ahead.
Yeah, but, you know, we didn't have this problem with, you know, with India and even Pakistan. I don't know about you. I've never really been entirely comfortable with Pakistan having nuclear weapons.
No, I wouldn't say I am.
Yeah,
no.
Yeah.
However, they have them, and we've accepted them.
Correct.
So because we've accepted them, we have been able to talk to them.
And we're going to have to accept them having them. Because it's too late to do anything about it. They already have them. So I guess we are going to have to live with it, but I'm not entirely comfortable with a guy who, and again, maybe I'm focusing too much on the concentration camps. Maybe it's just me. That sticks out. That sticks out.
Mercury. Love. Courage. Truth.
This is one of those moments. The standoff between North Korea and the United States is approaching an endgame. Change on a level not seen since World War II could be taking place very, very soon. a vehicle of this change comes in the form of a UN draft resolution. It was shown to the media yesterday. A lot of people aren't talking about it, but it's really important. The United States is seeking an oil embargo, and regardless of whether this resolution passes or fails, the conflict now with North Korea is reaching an inflection point. But let's say for a minute the embargo passes. This would mark the beginning of the end for diplomacy. And here's why. Japan saw an oil embargo as an act of war during World War II. It is what led to them launching against Pearl Harbor. Kim Jong-un is either going to be forced to the negotiating table, or he's going to see it as the Japanese did, as an act of war. And if war occurs, it will be catastrophic on both sides. Carnage not measured in hundreds and thousands, but hundreds of thousands. China and Russia already have made statements hinting that they will veto the resolution. And without the help of both countries, we're staring at very hard and cold truths that none of us want to face, and that is North Korea is now a nuclear-armed nation, and the world is stuck with accepting it, or we go it alone. Now think of the dominoes that might fall if that happens. Would Kim Jong-un take his newly acquired nuclear deterrence out for a test drive? If this happens, U.S. security guarantees in place since World War II, all of those guarantees would be worthless. Japan would need to rearm. The Philippines would most likely return to China. History is full of watershed moments, and it is the moments in between those watershed moments that make up most people's lives. We have been living in those moments between. But it is those moments that flip everything upside down and inside out and send the world hurling in a new and different direction. We're living right now in one of those moments.
Thursday, September 7th. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Managing editor of TheBlaze.com, Leon Wolf. Hello, Leon. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on, Glenn.
Yeah, good. It's good to have you here. You're in town for really a couple of weeks. We're making some pretty profound changes at The Blaze. Would you characterize that?
I would agree. Yeah. I would agree. Definitely.
Leon and I have been working hand in hand and close for a while over the summer trying to figure out. We know what the problem is, and the problem is that people want to read what reinforces their opinion. They read the clickbait, they read the dramatic headlines. And then when you actually get to any meat, people don't read that. If you're anything like me, you'll see a long story that has meat and you'll click on it and you'll save it and you put it in a folder and you go, I got to come back to that. And then you never do. And then you end up deleting, or like I do, just stop looking at that folder because then I start to feel guilty about all the things that I didn't read. And so it's really hard. How do we find ways to get the news to people and have them actually consume it and share it without causing more chaos?
Yeah.
That's hard.
Yeah, it's difficult. You know, we're making a bet, you know, as you know, Glenn, that people are getting tired of, you know, the way that the media is kind of responding to a lot of the market initiatives, right? I mean, if you look at CNN has been biased for years. But if you look at the way they've been since Trump took office,
new records are being set. Yes, every
really
day.
It really is. It's really something else. They have completely fallen into the trap of, hey, listen, we're going to give the hashtag resistance people what they want. They're absolutely gone down the path of MSNBC. Not across the board, but
with some exceptions.
Yeah, with some exceptions. But for the most part, they're like, hey, man, we can be MSNBC too. You know, the bet is that there's a lot of people out there who are kind of tired of
both
kind of competing visions of we're just going to give you the news that already confirms what you believe in, and with as much anger in our tone as we can possibly muster.
Don't you think, well, there's nobody doing it yet, but don't you think that, you know, I was talking to Dana last night. We were talking about the state of the media, you know, off air. And you know, I said, Dana, look at the numbers of Fox, but then look at the numbers of MSNBC.
Yeah.
Because while they're dominating right now, they're about half the size of what Bill O'Reilly was.
Right.
You know, so while they may have seemingly grown, they really haven't. Those outrageous numbers are actually very small in comparison to what used to be number one. People are, they're tired of it on both sides. I think they don't want anything to do with it.
Yeah. So the challenge then is to how to package meaningful stuff into a way that, you know, it kind of self-selects for, you know, people. You know, not everybody has the same set of interests.
Yeah.
Everybody is kind of moving, you know, quickly from one thing to the next. And they want to be able to kind of select what's of interest to them and deep dive into that stuff instead of kind of being force fed, you know, here's 1,100 words on something you might or might not care about. So that's, we're kind of, you know, working on a way to provide stuff that is easily digestible for folks on one hand. But on the other hand, if you look at the easily digestible part of it and you say, my gosh, this is interesting, I want to read more, you can drill down and find more really good right. kind of intelligent stuff about that.
And also trying to separate the opinion from fact, because right. people don't even know, you know, when the president gave a historic speech yesterday, that's editorial.
Right.
Just so adding the word historic is editorial. Here's what is a fact. The president gave a speech. Now, in the opinion part, I can say, here's why I think it's historic, because this has never been done for good or for ill. That's what makes it historic.
Well, technically, anything that happened in the past is historic. So I don't know if that is.
See, this is, we need him on the team, don't you think?
Yes,
Leon, very helpful. Is, yeah, no, nice. He's very helpful.
No, thank you for the very, very entry good. There, Stu.
Yeah,
appreciate
very
that.
Good. You should teach philosophy. That's what you should do.
Thank you.
So, Leon, let's help me find perspective on this story. Help me find the perspective on what happened yesterday with Donald Trump.
Okay, like what specifically with the Democrats making the
yeah.
deal with the Democrats?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. No, it's I saw a tweet on this that I thought was interesting, that the belief is that Donald Trump has gained the insight that he has a certain number of people who are with him no matter what, and he can increase his popularity by working with Democrats, just giving the Democrats whatever they want, and his core people are going to stay with him pretty much no matter what he does, which is an interesting gamble. It is an interesting gamble. And I've said a number of times,
we did talk to some people today that would pretty much bear that out as fruit. We talked to a guy who there's no way he was saying, oh, no, you know, DACA is fine. We got to do what we got to do for the Dreamers.
Yeah.
There's no way he was saying that during the election.
Yeah.
but he was saying that today. And, you know, I'm just, you know, it's the GOP that's the problem.
I mean, the Lou Dobbs thing from last night was a perfect example of this. I don't know if you happened to hear that, Leon, but
I mean,
it was an amazing feat of mental gymnastics to say that Trump was helping his side of the argument.
So let's come back to that. But it's specifically the Lou Dobbs thing here in a second. But so continue on with your perspective on, okay, you got the people that are going to probably follow him no matter what.
Yeah. Well, I think that what Trump might not fully understand yet, because he is new to politics, and I always try to kind of give him credit for that, you know, wherever I can, is that the legislative calendar is working against him in a big time way right now. And what he gave the Democrats was basically 2 weeks in December that he can't afford to lose. If we assume that he continues to want to pass items on his agenda like tax reform, funding the wall, those kinds of things. Congress is so far behind the ball right now in terms of getting this stuff passed. They're talking about this big tax reform package right now that they know they're going to have to pass through reconciliation because there are not 60 votes for the plan. So they know they're going to have to pass it through reconciliation. What nobody's talking about right now, or very few people are talking about right now, is that you can't pass a bill through the Senate under reconciliation until you have a budget resolution passed, which they haven't even started on. They haven't even started working on. And that's For those of us who followed politics for a long time, hammering out a budget resolution takes time. I mean, you have to get a lot of people on board. And right now, Paul Ryan in the House does not have the votes on board. I mean, I've talked to people from the Freedom Caucus. They're like, we are so far apart on anything approaching a budget resolution that we're weeks away from having like an introductory step for tax return. Forget funding the wall or whatever. So whatever you think about McConnell and Ryan, and I'm not big fans of theirs. I'm very skeptical about their leadership abilities.
You're so
they
kind.
Know they're looking at their calendar and they know that they had all these plans, like a best case scenario. We can maybe get to tax reform this year. We can maybe do some infrastructure spending. And the reason they were so, we need to get, the debt ceiling tacked onto this relief bill and, or at least push it out 6 months, was that they knew that agreeing to 3 months just basically dropped a 2-week bomb into the middle of December on their calendar, that everybody's going to have to debate raising the debt ceiling again in December. So the chances of any of this stuff being passed this year, I think,
so why
more
did
or less
it?
Just went out the window.
Somebody said to me 2 hours ago, you know what? Trump is just, remember, he's a deal maker. He just is seeing something that we're not seeing. To me, that sounds like, John Roberts. Oh, no, you don't understand. He went with this because he's going to drop a bomb. No, he didn't. No, we have Obamacare. So why do you think he made this deal?
You know, I think it was just, kind of a short-term vision. I mean, I think that I'd like to think that he's not naive enough to believe that when it comes to something that's important, like it's cost-free for the Democrats to give him this, right? Oh, yeah, sure. We'll give you the relief funding. We'll kick the debt ceiling can down the road. That costs them nothing. I hope that he doesn't believe that when he then comes to them and says, oh, yeah, now let's talk about cutting a deal on the border wall, that they're going to be cooperative in any way. And I think that maybe he thinks that in the back of his mind, because that's maybe how he's used to the business people he's used to dealing with will work. But that's not how Chuck Schumer works. That's not how Nancy Pelosi works. I mean, we've seen it for years and years and years.
He'll take what he wants this time, and next time he'll demand what he wants again.
Next time he'll say, hey, guys, remember how we worked this deal out? And they're going to be like, no, I'm not.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we've seen it for years and years, so I don't know.
Wait until you hear Lou Dobbs. We'll get to that here in a second. So here is Lou Dobbs last night talking about. Now, remember, Lou Dobbs, when I was at CNN, he was on CNN and they deemed him a madman because of the border. All he cares about is the border. At least that's the Lou that, I was working with at CNN. And yesterday, we didn't get anything done on the border. And in fact, we probably hurt that cause with the border. But here is Lou Dobbs.
A few thoughts now on the death of a rhino. Nothing to lament here. We're just examining politics in 2017. I'm talking about Speaker Paul Ryan and his obsequious deference to corporate lobbyists, his unbridled hostility toward President Trump. The president not only took Rhino Ryan to the woodshed, but eliminated any need for any Republican to ever pretend again that Ryan is a real Republican in any way, or that any Rhino has a political future after Mr. Trump simply booted the hapless fool of a speaker out of the way of those trying to get the nation's business done. Here's the clueless Ryan just this morning talking about a proposal tying Harvey funding to an increase in the debt ceiling.
What the leaders you just described proposed is unworkable. I think that's ridiculous and disgraceful that they want to play politics with the debt ceiling at this moment. I think that's a ridiculous idea. I hope that they don't mean that.
They did mean that. And it wasn't so ridiculous, it turns out, because within just a few hours, President Trump reached a deal with the Democrats to raise the debt limit to fund the government until mid-December, while providing funds for Harvey relief. Deal done. President Trump also clearing the way for tax reform while he was at it. Contrast Ryan's inane insults, his obstinance and subversion of President Trump, to the behavior and the rhetoric of Democratic leadership of late. They've calmed themselves. They've been far more conciliatory in their rhetoric over recent weeks. And now Ryan is fully exposed to the nation.
Okay, stop.
He is.
Probably, I mean, I don't know who the good guy is here. I don't know the guy, because I don't like Paul Ryan. I do not like Paul Ryan, but that's not my read of stuff.
No, I don't. I'm not a fan of his either. But it's clear from people that I talked to in both the House and the Senate that Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, the reason they wanted to raise the debt ceiling for 18 months again was to clear the decks of that issue for the rest of this congressional term in order to work on items that are on Trump's stated agenda.
Yeah,
that's the reason they wanted. They said, we don't want to have to keep debating the debt ceiling every 3 months. We're behind on tax reform. We're behind on infrastructure. We're behind on funding the wall. All those things are things that they are actually working on, which for better or worse.
Which we now will have to take a break and come back in December
and fight about the debt ceiling.
And fight about the debt ceiling.
It's so. I mean, I'm not. Paul Ryan sucks in a lot of ways, but the idea that you prove that Paul Ryan isn't a Republican by a Republican president siding with the Democrats. What possible mental gymnastics could you come up with to make that point make any sense at all? And then I love the idea, because you just mentioned this. He cleared the way for tax reform, because Chuck Schumer in a few months is going to be like, you know what? You guys gave us that debt ceiling thing. You know what? We're going to do that tax reform for you.
Yeah.
That's intentional insanity. There's nothing even remotely close to the way this world works that reflects that point.
Talking to Leon Wolfe, he's the managing editor for The Blaze. Leon, what do you make of Nancy Pelosi, obviously, leaking that she called Donald Trump up this morning and said, hey, can you tweet that if you are in DACA, that there's nothing to worry about, no action is going to be taken right away. And then as soon as he tweets it, she releases to somebody at Politico, you know what, I called him. I mean, if that's not a passive-aggressive move,
That's aggressive. That's not passive aggressive.
That's crazy.
How can Trump has to respond to that, right?
You
would think he would, like, if he's not, like, in writing saying, like, if there's not screenshots of a text conversation between him and Nancy Pelosi where he's like, okay, sure, I'll tweet it, he's got to come out and say, no, there's no way I did that.
She's now come out and said it publicly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She was
on MSNBC. Yeah. As soon as he did it, it was almost like she planned it. Right. I'm sure she did. You know, I'm gonna ask him to tweet this, and he's gonna do it, and then I'm gonna go back out and because there's only one reason to do that, and that is to get people on the right to say
it's trolling. Yeah,
yeah. Trump. Look at what Donald Trump is doing.
It's true. It's purely trying to embarrass. I'm skeptical. I'm skeptical that happened, but we'll see. We'll see what Trump says. I mean, who knows? Who knows?
You're not saying reporters would not tell you the truth.
Well, the truth as they received it from Nancy Pelosi?
Right. Sometimes unnamed sources are better.
What is truth? Right.
Yeah. I mean, because now that she said it, I believe it less than when it was from an unnamed source.
Right.
When Nancy Pelosi comes out and says something, there's zero connection to the truth.
Can I talk about something that I want to talk to, that I think America needs to hear from Leon, and that is Logan Lucky.
Oh, man. Great movie. Great. Glenn and I both saw it this weekend. What did you think about it?
I loved it. If you liked Ocean's 11, they say it in the middle of the movie, and it's true. This is Ocean's 7-Eleven. This is Ocean's 11 in West Virginia, and it is so well done. You will love this movie.
Here's what I really liked about the movie. And there have been some people who are conservatives who watch it who think, you know, oh, this is Hollywood making fun of people, you know, who live in the sticks. There's a little bit of that, but I think, for the most part, it's a pretty genuine portrayal of a lot of the struggles these people have.
You'll love it.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
There's some great stories. The one you have to read on The Blaze, the unsung heroes, the couple in Houston that were supposed to get married, and they ended up canceling because they wanted to help all of their friends and neighbors, and they took all of the food that they had purchased for the for their wedding and their reception and delivered it down to the victims of Hurricane Harvey. And we are keeping an eye on Irma as it's starting to come on shore here in the next couple of days. We will have operations up and running. Of course, they are still running in Texas, and we will have more up and running in Florida with mercury1.org if you would like to help with that. Pat is here with his point of view on, I can't wait to hear on what he is.
You're talking about the new host of the Pat Gray Experience show?
Is it Unleashed? Thing?
Yeah. Unleashed.
Is that what it is?
Is it officially named yet?
I think it's Unleashed, yeah.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Pat Gray really Unleashed?
Mm-hmm.
Nice. That's kind of what I joked about a couple of weeks ago with you. Is like,
it sort of is.
Yeah, Pat Gray Unleashed. And so he's kind of taken that to heart.
Yeah.
I'm interested in hearing what your thoughts are. We spoke to listeners about an hour and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we spoke to a couple. So, you know, just getting a small sample size. But we spoke to some people that were not too happy with what's happening with Donald Trump. And
what?
And some that think that this is a well-laid plan.
Well, look, I know that we're calling my upcoming show on Monday Pat Gray Unleashed, but and that might imply perhaps a dash of angst or maybe a smidge of anger from time to time. But I got to tell you, I am feeling nothing but happiness and pride today. Happiness and pride.
That's really good.
Good to hear.
I am proud of our president for reaching across the aisle, right?
Okay, yep.
Who does that? Nobody does that. Even my friends at Fox, who always seem to encourage working with Democrats, right? They, along with me, are really elated today. Listen to this.
The president of the United States, a Republican, made a deal with the Democrats. That's the headline. The president overruled his Treasury Secretary and the congressional leadership on the Republican side, who wanted a debt ceiling increase and fund the government and to get $8 billion for Harvey. They wanted it to go limit to go past next year's midterm elections.
They want to kick it all the way down.
Right. Democrats just wanted 3 months. And you know what? The president, not wanting to fight, apparently said, that's the deal I'm going to take right now because we've got tax reform and other stuff we got to do right now.
Good for him. He's doing this for the
good
folks
for
that are affected by Harvey. I remember originally he said he was going to give, it was like $5.95 billion to the folks in Texas. And then we had, I think, Chris Christie on the couch one leader, another governor, who said, that's not enough money. He needs to give more. Now he's giving $8 billion to help those families, and it's great.
Well, some conservatives are upset because they want... Big time. But you know what? This is
they're
a clear shot at Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan. Hey, guys, if you can't get things done, then I'll go work with the Democrats.
Right?
Oh, that's great.
Let's hope the president can also work with the Democrats on tax reform, fixing Obamacare, the wall... comprehensive immigration reform.
That one's going to happen.
That's going to happen.
That one's going to happen.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if he worked with Democrats on solidifying a woman's right to choose pretty soon.
Right, yeah.
Let's reach across that aisle. Let's do this. It's so great to have the unanimity.
Did you think it was great that it wasn't just against Paul Ryan or the congressional leadership, but it was against the advice of the Treasury Secretary?
That's
always a good one.
Because usually the Treasury Secretary wants the debt thing done as fast as possible.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
No, he was actually arguing for a longer term.
And they're making this out like, okay, well, it's a really good thing that he tied it to the Hurricane Harvey relief effort. Because now Democrats... we'll have to vote for it. Well, first of all, no, they don't. But secondly, when has it ever been tough to get Democrats to vote for an increase in the debt ceiling? You're acting like that's a miracle. The Democrats are going to vote for a debt ceiling increase? What? You mean like they've done every time since 1791? Huh? Wow. I'm surprised. The world didn't just turn upside down all of a sudden.
But you're the expert maybe on the Constitution out of all of us, certainly more than me and Glenn. So, question. The President of the United States makes a deal with the Democratic senators and House members. How is that a bill? That's not a bill, is it?
They're acting like it's a done deal, and I'm thinking, well... isn't there some sort of a, I don't know, what do you call that? Vote?
Right.
There's got to be a sort of a, with Congress to pass a law, there's got to be a
vote.
But you know that now the Republicans can't do anything about it, because then they will be against something that is so bipartisan, and you're against all the people in Houston, and you're going against this president because you only want to see him fail. I mean, he has set up Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan, and I said don't partner with them, you know, 2 years ago, 5 years ago, but when he was saying, you know, we're going to partner, I was saying no.
No.
Okay. So they did it anyway. But now when you have to actually have somebody in Congress that will push through legislation like tax reform, when you need somebody to actually help you on this DACA thing, he's setting them up for failure. There's no way for them to get tax reform done. There's no way, because they're going to be arguing about
compromise with the Democrats now.
Yes. And so now
he set that precedent, and now they're going to use it the rest of his term.
And you said earlier you were happy about that, right?
I couldn't be happier, okay, Stu. I am so proud that we're finally coming together. Mm-hmm. We're finally working in unison on these things.
So it's now, great. Pat, because I remember there were a lot of voices that have been very upset with me when I said, hey, let's reach across to people, not politically, not reach across the political
such
aisle.
That's a great point.
We don't compromise what we're looking for, but we do reach across the aisle to find people who are just as sick of this game as we are. And I remember there were a lot of people that were very upset because you're just going to be used. You're just a pawn. You've sold out everything. Even though I say, no, I'm still for all of the things I've always been for. They didn't accept that. I'm trying to understand.
Well,
should I have given up all of my principles and reach across the aisle? Because that's what it seems like is popular now.
Well, you just have to remember three things.
What?
Yeah, but Trump.
Mm.
Everything you said is true. Yeah, but Trump.
That's a good point.
It's where it ends.
That's a good point.
It's where it ends.
I like that.
You can't argue with it.
No, you really... Well, you can.
You just won't get anywhere.
You're not going to get anywhere. Is a story about Boomer and Carton, and you may not know who they are. Boomer Esiason and Carton, Craig Carton. Mm-hmm. They do mornings on WFAN in New York. They replace Don Imus. I have to call Don today and see if he will come on
jeez. You want Imus on talking about that?
Oh, I'd love to have Imus on tomorrow and talk about this. So Boomer was on, and he's like, Craig's not around. I don't know what's happening with Craig.
He called in sick on me.
Yeah. They found out later in the show he wasn't sick. He has been arrested by the FBI. And apparently Craig was a part of a Ponzi scheme.
Well, I mean, I don't think, to my view, not technically. Basically, what happened was he got into a little debt, apparently, with gambling.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is the report. He was arrested by the FBI. So this is a pretty big deal. But he would a lot of debt, hundreds and thousands of dollars, maybe millions of dollars in gambling debt to casinos and other sources.
Oh, so all the best people.
All
the best people.
All the best people.
Yeah.
So he realized he was in trouble with this. And they came up with him and a business partner came up with a plan.
Ah.
And this plan was pretty interesting, actually, because he had access to these concert promoters where he could buy tour tickets for Katy Perry, Justin Bieber, Roger Waters, Metallica, Barbara Streisand. Streisand and others like Hamilton, the play. And
oh,
the,
wow. Those are, yeah,
big
you,
ones.
You could get those in bulk?
Yeah, he'd get them in bulk at face value.
Holy cow. That's a lot of money.
So pretty easy you know, business here, right? Yeah, as long as you have the capital up front to pay for the tickets, you take the tickets and you bring them to StubHub or something, and you're going to guarantee yourself a huge profit.
Huge profit.
You pay back the original money.
Sure.
You take a nice chunk for yourself.
Sure.
You reward the investors. It's actually it's a pretty good idea.
Right.
There was a minor hole in it.
Yeah.
He did not have access to any of the tickets. So he wasn't buying the tickets with the money. He was
Nor selling them.
Right. He was just buying.
He was selling the shares, investment opportunities for people.
He was taking money, right, from the investors.
Right. To buy the tickets.
Well, then he was paying off his gambling debts.
Ah.
Instead of buying the tickets.
So then how would he pay off the investors?
He would take money from new investors,
and
he would pay off the old investors. So the old investors would get their money.
Right. So nobody loses here, really.
Well, there's like one set of investors that might lose.
Right.
But again, investing's risky, right?
Right.
And so people are calling this a Ponzi scheme, but what they don't understand is that no one's name in the story is Ponzi.
Right. Charles Ponzi's been dead for a long time.
A long time.
Right.
He had a particular scheme that he ran. That same scheme.
Right. What he did was he would take money from people and he would say, I'm going to invest in something. And then he didn't. And then he would just take money from new investors and give it to the old investors while enriching himself.
But what was his name?
Charles Ponzi.
Right. So that's a Ponzi scheme.
Right.
This would be, if you want to call it a Carton scheme, you can
try
that.
It's a Carton scheme. But it is completely different than Ponzi.
Totally different. The name.
Holy cow.
The letters are.
You know, when Charles Ponzi did that, I mean, you know, Charles Ponzi, it's called a Ponzi scheme. And he was pretty clear about it, at least at the beginning. He was really trying to buy these. Yeah, he was up front. He was like, this is the deal. We're going to buy these. I think they were stamps. We're going to buy these Italian stamps. And we're gonna we'll then send them back because you get you get money back. It's kind of like buying a bunch of return this bottle, refund
the old Seinfeld scheme where they're gonna take it from the 5-cent state and return them in the 10-cent state.
That's exactly what the Ponzi scheme started as, except they were stamps, and it was working with the Italian post office, and so it was legitimate. The idea was legitimate, and then he started raising money for it, and then he realized, oh, that won't work. But he had raised the money.
Raised the money, right.
And so he was like, God, I raised so much money, and so why don't I just pay off these investors and invest some more? Because I'm sure at some point we're going to be able to make that work.
Mm.
So, you know, he entered it kind of thinking, I'm going to actually do it. It doesn't sound like Mr. Carton here has had any intention of actually.
Right. And of course, now, so far, these things are alleged, right? It might not be true. The other part of it is you get yourself into these dark corners of your life and you do lots of things you did not consider doing before. I mean, he at one point had, and this is according to his emails, $2.5 million in outstanding debt and through gambling that was due in the next 30 days. So I don't know. I don't even know how through a casino you could do that. It's got to be other stuff too.
Do you think you might have a problem?
It's possible.
I'm thinking if you have two of any number more than two zeros after the two, you might have a problem.
So the total number he's believed to have put through this scheme is $5.6 million. And to further the scheme, because these are hedge fund guys, here's a guy I listen to the radio every morning. I can't imagine he's going to scam me. So he had made, allegedly, these documents and had them signed from the concert promoters showing that they had purchased the tickets. I mean, they went pretty far down this line to cover this. I don't know how you think you're getting out of that. Maybe you think you're going to go to the casino and hit one day and you'll be able to pay it all back. I don't know
what a gambler does.
I guess that's where it goes. But that is, you're deep into it. And again, this is a job that he was just voted. I think I read in one of these stories that he was voted the number two most influential sports personality in America.
Yeah, not anymore.
Yeah, not anymore. I mean, but this is a good gig. He's on in New York. He's on TV. They had a TV simulcast of the show as well.
Jeez.
This is a
What's
good
Boomer
gig.
Saying? What's Boomer I mean, he's, what's going to happen to Boomer now?
He'll keep that gig, I'm sure. Boomer Esiason, of course, a famous NFL quarterback, as I know you know.
I actually do.
He said he loved him for 10 years, will still continue to love him, but it's a dark time.
Mercury.